Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, the Doctrine of God, Part 6. For more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
We've been talking about God's eternity and his relationship to time. And the last session we were together, just to recap, we looked at arguments for divine timelessness, and I said that really about the only good argument there is the argument from the incompleteness of temporal life, that does provide, I think, a motivation for a doctrine of divine timelessness if there weren't countervailing arguments on the other side. But I did present then two arguments that I think are countervailing, namely the argument based upon God's real relation to a temporal world, and then the argument based upon God's knowledge of tensed facts, both of which would seem to require that God be in time. By way of evaluating these arguments, I said it really is going to depend on what theory of time you adopt. Do you think that tense, that is that feature of reality that has to do with what is now or present, as opposed to past and future, do you think that tense is an objective feature of reality, or do you think that's just an illusion of human consciousness? Do you think that temporal becoming is real, that things really do come into being and go out of being, or do you think that temporal becoming is, again, just an illusion of human consciousness, that things in the past, the present, and the future are all equally real, and that there really is no temporal becoming? And my argument was that if you adopt the view that says tense and temporal becoming are an objective feature of the world, independent of human experience, then that gives good grounds for thinking that God must know tensed facts and therefore must be temporally located, and that in virtue of his changing relationships with a world that is dynamic and undergoing becoming, God would be temporal as well. So it seems to me that given that so-called A theory of time, as we labeled it, we have good grounds for thinking that God is, in fact, temporal. Now, that leads to a problem. Since time had a beginning and God didn't have a beginning, how are we to understand God's relationship to time? And the proposal that I suggested was that we think of God as being timeless without creation and temporal from the moment of creation on. That is to say, God existing alone without the world, creating nothing, is timeless. But that with the decision to create a temporal world, God condescends to abandon timelessness, to enter into time in virtue of his real relationship with the temporal world, and therefore is in time from the moment of creation onward. Now, we had begun to have some discussion among the group, which was cut short by the end of the hour, so I want to open the floor again to further discussion of these issues before we go on. Yes, Steve.
Got a question. I like everything, but when you say when you said after creation, God is temporal in time, that would imply that objectively the present and the past exist, but I think you would have to say the future does not yet exist.
Well, there are different views on that. Some people would say what you said, that the past and the present both exist, so that the people back there in the year 2000 are just as real as we are, or the people in 2000 BC are just as real as we are, but there aren't any people in the future, that's unreal. That's one view. I don't think that that's a good view. I think that runs into some of the same problems that a pure B theory has. And so my preferred view would be to say only what exists presently is real. The things in the past have ceased to exist. Things in the future haven't yet existed. So that the only thing that actually exists is that which exists presently. And that, I think, is a pure A theory of time. Very often this view of time is called presentism. Presentism is the view that the only temporal items that exist are things that exist presently. Okay, there's some other questions here. Yes, Susie.
This one may stump you.
Okay.
Would you define real? You keep using the word real. I mean, obviously the past is real, but do you mean like real now?
I don't mean real now. That would be to say that it's present, and obviously the past isn't present. That would be a contradiction. What I mean by real is that the thing actually exists independently of our knowledge of it, experience of it, independently of our minds. Certain things don't exist in a mind-independent way. What would be an example of that? Ideas, for example. You might say, well, the idea of Bugs Bunny exists. People have that idea. But that idea isn't mind-independent. If there weren't any minds, it wouldn't be there. Is the past like that? Do dinosaurs and things in the past actually exist? Well, I want to say no. They actually exist dead. They once were real, but they now are no longer real. Does that help?
Not really.
All right. Well, explain to me then what it is that you're having difficulty grasping. I know these are hard concepts.
Are we saying that history is not real because we were not there? I'm losing that.
I'm not contrasting real with illusory. Certainly the past is real in the sense that I'm not saying the past is an illusion, but I'm saying that the things in the past don't exist anymore. They once existed, but they don't exist anymore. They have ceased to be. Now, on the so-called B theory of time, that is not the case. On a B theory of time, if we were to draw, say, a picture of the universe that expands from the Big Bang like this, and then say it recontracts to the Big Crunch, so that time is the vertical dimension here, and the spatial dimensions would be these two flat dimensions that this cross section of the space-time continuum would represent. And on the B theory, the things say that this is 2008, this cross section here. The things that existed at earlier times on the B theory are just as real as the things that exist in 2008. And the things in 3008 are just as real as the things in 2008 on this. On this view, there just isn't any becoming. Things don't come into existence. They don't go out of existence. Things just exist at the various points in time at which they're located. By contrast, on presentism, only the present exists. And when I say these other things earlier and later than it aren't real, what I mean is that they don't exist. The things that exist, exist presently, and these other things don't exist. That's what I mean when I say they're not real. Now, does that help? Okay, good. Okay, yeah, Dennis?
How do Kant's ideas come into this? Are you saying in the B theory that it's as though all times exist simultaneously and it's just a matter of human perception?
All right, now we have to be careful here. We have to be careful here, Dennis. It's not the case on the B theory that all times exist simultaneously. Right. That would be to say they all exist at the same time. Right. Which they obviously don't. These are different times, but they all exist equally. You could say they're all equally real. Okay. They all exist, whereas on the A theory, they're not all equally real. Now, Kant's view that Dennis asked about, he was an 18th century German philosopher who believed, in fact, that time and space are the products of human consciousness. He was a total anti-realist about time and space. He didn't even think the present was real. He thought that time and space are categories or forms that the human mind imposes on reality, which is just, I mean, a wild view. I don't know anybody who really believes this today, who thinks that the Jurassic Age never really existed, but this is a product of human consciousness. But that was Kant's view. He was a subjectivist in that sense, that he thought the human mind structures reality to make it seem like things are in time and space.
Okay. How many people would anybody adhere to the B theory of time today?
The B theory is very popular, especially among physicists and philosophers of science. And the reason is that the way general relativity and special relativity are typically discussed in science is in terms of this tenseless four-dimensional geometry. The three dimensions of space and the one dimension of time form a kind of four-dimensional geometrical object called space-time. And therefore, many physicists and philosophers of science, I think uncritically, assume that this construct of space-time, this four-dimensional geometrical object called space-time, actually exists, that they read this space-time notion as being a literal description of reality. And so the B theory is very popular today among physicists and philosophers of science. And which table? Over here. Oh, okay. let me just take that question, because that's a good question. The only people who take time travel seriously as a real possibility are B theorists. And why? Well, because the future actually exists. The past actually exists. So you could go there. But on the A theory, there isn't any such thing as the past or the future. And so you almost inevitably find that the proponents or the enthusiasts for time travel are B theorists. Now, that doesn't mean if you are a B theorist, you have to believe in the possibility of time travel. But it does seem that the B theory is a necessary condition of time travel being possible. And it certainly is the case that all of the time travel enthusiasts today are B theorists. Okay, over here.
Let's see, on the last question, you kind of segued into, I guess, my question, which was, how are you to reconcile this relativity to the A theory of time, considering everyone is, by Einstein's theories, on a different sort of time dimension? Would you say there's a universal starting point or a universal viewpoint or something? I don't know.
This is a really good question. In fact, there are three physical interpretations of the equations of relativity theory. There was Einstein's original interpretation. Then there was Hermann Minkowski's four-dimensional space-time interpretation. And then there was the Dutch physicist H.A. Lorentz's interpretation. These three physical interpretations of the mathematical core of relativity theory are empirically equivalent. That is to say, they all explain the physical experiments, but they differ very radically in their understanding of the nature of reality. The four-dimensional space-time interpretation is actually due to Hermann Minkowski, who proposed this in 1908. Einstein's original formulation of special relativity in 1905 was actually using the traditional concepts of time and space, that time is separate from space, that it's not united into one geometrical object called space-time. Similarly, Lorentz's theory doesn't presuppose a geometrical interpretation. And what happened was that Minkowski's view came to be the sort of orthodox or received interpretation of relativity theory. And Einstein himself, as soon as he heard it, abandoned his original physical interpretation and adopted Minkowski's, because it's so much easier to work with. It provides a very easy framework for understanding relativity theory and the relation of things in space and time. But what I think the original Einstein interpretation, or Lorentz would say, is that this is just a diagram. This is not a picture of the way reality is. And in the same way that you could construct a continuum that was, say, formed of temperature and pressure, and you could have something that would plot a thing's shape in this temperature-pressure continuum, you can do that with space and time as well. But nobody would take seriously the idea that there is such a thing called temperature pressure. It's just a diagrammatic device for understanding two physical realities that are in nature quite distinct. Yes?
I guess still at the same time, though, then how would you reconcile the empirical evidence that you could stand right there and then I could run across the room, so to say, and then for what you would be 1 second, for me would be, I believe, less than a second. So
yeah.
Whereas we started at the same point in time, you are at a different point in time along that continuum
right.
than I would be.
That issue is neutral between these three interpretations. All three of these interpretations predict those same results. And if you're interested in how this works out, take a look at my book, Time and Eternity, where this is discussed. But what we're talking about here is about the difference between the A theory and the B theory of time. Two of the interpretations of relativity theory, the original Einsteinian interpretation and Lorentz's, are consistent with an A theory. It's only Minkowski's view that requires the B theory approach. And these are all empirically equivalent. So there's nothing in relativity theory that says you have to be a B theorist and think that time is tenseless and that becoming is an illusion. Robert.
Yes, my question was also on time and time travel. As we're always cutting edge here in the Defenders class, and most people, the advancement of science and knowledge is increasing exponentially, and I think your average layperson has no idea how fast we are accumulating knowledge. And
yeah.
We are right on the cusp. I am very interested in these things, and theoretically, they're right on the cusp of breakthrough experiments and time, transporting material atoms, and we're right on the cusp of perhaps a breakthrough in time travel. Now, my question would be, what are the theological – if we were able to successfully take something and move it through time – what theological implications might that have?
Yeah. Well, now, let's be careful in the way you word it. We move things through time all the time. All you have to do is just stand still, and you move through time. This object endures from a moment ago to present. So things in that sense endure through time all the time. But what you're talking about would be if we were able to, say, go back in time or leap into the future in a way that would not involve enduring through time, but to make a kind of leap ahead into the future. What would be the theological implications of that? I'm not really sure. Are you thinking of something specifically?
Able to do this on a yes. small scale. If people will then abandon faith in God because of it.
I guess I don't see the relevance of it to belief in God.
It would be tampering, the long term would be people being able to tamper with history, or, you know.
Yeah.
If that ever went that far, but I'm not even saying it's going that far with. I'm just talking about with material things that basically.
Well, let me say this with respect to the question of tampering with history. The literature on time travel is very, very similar to the literature on divine foreknowledge of the future, because they involve parallel problems. For example, if Jesus predicts Judas's betrayal of him, then when the time comes, does Judas have the freedom not to betray Christ? Well, yes, he doesn't have to do it. He's not fated to do it. Judas could have done otherwise and not betrayed Jesus. But in that case, that means Judas had the ability to do something, which is such that if he had done it, then either you'd have to say Jesus' prediction was wrong, or else Jesus would not have made that prediction. Now, since Jesus is the Son of God, he can't be wrong. So what that means is that Judas has the ability to do something which is such that if he were to do it, then the past would have been different. Jesus would never have made this prediction. So up until the time of his betrayal, Judas had the ability to do something such that if he were to do it, something that happened in the past wouldn't have happened. Now, that's exactly like time travel. The time traveler has the ability to pull the levers on his machine to do certain things such that if he were to do them, then he could go back into the past and the past would have been different. Now, we know he won't do that because the past has already occurred. We know that he won't do those things, but he could do those things. And if he were to do them, then the past would have been different. So divine foreknowledge is very parallel to the idea of time travel. And I think that actually there are great theological lessons to be learned from reading the time travel literature in terms of understanding God's providence over human history, because God knows what we will do. And so he is able to predict these things in advance, but in such a way as to not abrogate our freedom. And similarly, if there were time travel, I would say, Robert, that God knows what the time traveler will do. And so he won't make any sort of mistake. It's not as though the time traveler could somehow fool God and go back in time and change things so that God was wrong. Given divine foreknowledge, he knows exactly what the time traveler will do. He'll know the time traveler, say, did go back in time and help the Egyptians build the pyramids. And he knows that the pyramids aren't going to disappear because the time traveler will change his mind and decide not to go back. You see what I mean? He knows all this. So it's all under his providential direction.
I was looking at it from the point of view of, let's say, life extension science. If we are able to extend life 50 years or 100 years, I believe a lot of people will begin to fall away from the faith because they will begin to think, well, God's not really in control, where I believe that would just be God allowing us.
Sure.
You know, because we live longer lives today than we did 100 years ago.
Right, exactly.
And so, but as it advances, you know, if we start being able to grow new hearts or, you know, it gets to that point where I think people begin to think that they are God. And, you know,
that may be. Now, that's a very different issue than what we're talking about there. You're just talking about advances in medicine and biology that would enable us to forestall the death of cells and live longer. And I agree with you entirely that there's just no reason to think that this isn't due to God-given potentialities in human biology and in human minds. Yes, Wayne.
Bill, if God is temporal, what do we say about his transcendence? And is God God subject to aging?
Right. God would not be subject to aging. To say he's temporal doesn't mean that he is subject to the laws of nature so that he would grow weary or weaker or impotent or senile or anything like that. It would mean that the entire process of human history is under his direction and control, but I guess it would mean that he's actually involved in it as it unfolds. He's actually doing it. One nice illustration of the difference between the B theory and the A theory would be the difference between a movie film as it lies in the can, and there's a frame with action on every frame in the can. Every frame on the film has action on it, but nothing's really happening. It's all just kind of frozen there in the can. The A theory is more like seeing the play actually being performed on the stage. It's actually happening. And there you could imagine the director, he's actually involved in seeing it happen rather than the person who is just sort of responsible for the, having the film in the can. Both of them would involve providence, but the A theory would be a much more active and kind of, I think, ongoing sort of process. And so I think of God's transcendence as being, first of all, that he set up the whole thing, that it was his decision to create time and space and to enter into them. He didn't have to. And that having done so, he now controls the course of human history to reach its eventual end and goal.
But he seems sort of trapped inside the space-time continuum under this theory to me. And I guess the other question is, at the end of this age, when God creates a new heaven and a new earth, if he's in time, and I don't know whether you assume time continues or not, but I guess I would assume that it doesn't.
Well, I think it will.
How does he get outside of time to recreate the new heavens and the new earth?
He wouldn't need to get outside of time, but he could create new laws of nature.
New
laws of physics so that clocks would run differently and so forth. But clearly, the new heavens and the new earth will be temporal because we will have resurrection bodies. And a resurrection body that isn't temporal would be frozen like an ice statue or a mannequin in a store window that wouldn't do anything. So that's contradictory to the very nature of a dynamic, active resurrection body. So there will clearly, I think, be time. That's why I take literally what the Bible says. He has given us everlasting life that will go on forever into eternity, into the future. But this language of being trapped or bound, it seems to me this is very emotionally laden language. I mean, in one sense, an individual who is timeless is trapped or bound because he can't do anything. He is frozen in immobility, and the minute he does anything, he becomes temporal. So I don't like I think the language of bound or so forth is kind of emotionally loaded. I would see this as being God's sovereign choice. He could have chosen to remain atemporal by not creating anything temporal, and he would have been perfect and fulfilled in the inter-Trinitarian relationships. But he willed to condescend to create a world of temporal creatures like ourselves and to be in relationship with those creatures, and that was his sovereign decision. And in one sense, as I said the other day, in creation, God condescends to take on our mode of existence, to have a relationship with us. And then in the incarnation, he condescends even further to take on not simply our mode of existence, but our very human nature, our very humanity, for our sake and our salvation. And so I see this as fitting with the character of this self-giving God who humbles himself in that way for the sake of the creatures he loves. Let me take one last question from Reed, and then we'll draw it to a close.
I'm sorry. I've been trying to get all this down, and then you made the film analogy, which
– yes.
Is the A theory more of a theory that's associated with free will and the B theory with predestination or even the deistic clockmaker theory?
Some people have tried to make that association. Some people have said on the B theory, everything's determined because it's already there. The future, everything you're going to do, your death, it's already there. It already exists. So they've said on the B theory, there really isn't any freedom. Whereas on the A theory, those things are unreal. They've yet to be created. You've yet to make those decisions. I don't buy that argument, though. I want to come to the B theorist's defense. It seems to me that the B theory is compatible with free will because a decision that is, say, made here in 3008 is not causally determined by events prior to it in, say, the year 3000. It can be causally indeterminate with respect to those events. Imagine this is the decay of a subatomic particle that is completely indeterminate causally. Just because it exists doesn't mean that it has causal antecedents that determine it. So it seems to me that this is consistent with saying that there are free will decisions, causally undetermined event, but they're just scattered throughout this four-dimensional space-time continuum. So although a lot of people have tried to make the association between the B theory and determinism or fatalism, I'm not convinced that that really goes through. And so that wouldn't be a reason I would give for rejecting the B theory.
Well, looking at how you've got it up there, it seems to me in order for the B theory to incorporate free will, each individual point on the figure would have to branch would have to branch off into another potential figure, each with infinitely many points branching off of that.
Yeah, you can make a different diagram like that of future the future that would involve branching, where there would be free decisions at these various nodes. But on the B theory, there is only one path through this structure that is the real world. The other ones are just causally potential paths that the universe could have taken. And so they're not real. Those are just possibilities that are causally possible. Those other branches are in no way real. The only thing that's real is the actual branch or the actual path through the branching structure that is made, and that's this four-dimensional continuum. Okay, well, that got into a lot of technical issues and so forth, but next time we'll meet, we'll continue the discussion, then I'll try to give some practical applications of the doctrine of divine eternity.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.